Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Empirical Labs founder and inventor of the Distressor, Dave Durr. First of all, radio is evolving, and with that evolution comes some changing music radio formats. That's actually a good thing, because I think a lot of us feel that radio is kind of stagnant, to use one word. There's probably lots of other ones that you can use, but that's one. And in fact, what we're finding is that radio is changing right before our eyes, and that's probably a good thing. The latest Nielsen survey found that adult contemporary radio is hot. As a matter of fact, it's starting to beat out pop CHR. CHR is contemporary hits radio, and this has been the largest pop format that's been around for a long, long time. Pop CHR listening levels are their lowest since 2011. They're down about 15%. Now, this, of course, skews pretty young, while adult contemporary skews a lot older. I shouldn't say a lot older, but older. Now, what's even more interesting is we're finding that outside of the top 50 markets, the most important radio format is country. Country is just killing everywhere except for the top 50 markets. So if you go to every state, basically, whatever their largest market is, country may not be in the top five, but what you'll find is if you go outside of those markets, country is just killing everywhere. So country is the favorite format of the United States right now. That being said, classic rock is still doing very well, and it's the top rock format. But we're finding that alternative, or sometimes they call it alternative rock, is right behind. And basically what that is new rock music that's just been released, plus some artists from the 1990s and 2000s. So what we're seeing, of course, is alternative is gaining audience while pop CHR is declining. I think that's showing a little bit about the type of music that's out there right now. A lot of people feel it's kind of repetitive and there's nothing really new and distinctive. And as a result, I think there's people that are kind of fleeing the format. Now, that being said, we're also getting a big evolution in radio listeners as younger listeners actually are listening more, as we've seen in past weeks when we've talked about this, they're listening more online than they are on the radio. Now, if you're a captive listener, meaning that you're in a car or you're at work, that's one thing. But if you have your choice in what to listen to, the younger the age, the more likely they're going to be listening online. And that's why we're seeing, I think, some of this decline in the format. Nonetheless, radio is changing. It always does. It's always a surprise. But right now, I think it's more of a surprise than it has been. And the last survey really has opened up some eyes in the industry. So let's see what happens in the next 6 months. At the end of the year, we can reevaluate this and see really what's happening. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Just a heads up that my new book, The Music Business Advice Book, will be available on August 7th. It's comprised of 150 immediately useful tips compiled from the interviews from this podcast. You'll be able to find the book on Amazon and most other online book retailers, as well as a bookstore near you. Now, we all buy gear. And many of us buy lots of it, and we may buy from our local retailer, we may buy it online, we may buy it from a big box music retailer, but I think it's interesting to really look at the figures that Music Trades comes out with and kind of analyze what's actually being sold and who's buying it and where they're buying it from. Well, when we look at the latest figures in Music Trades, we find out that the sales for just about all musical instruments are up. The only ones that are down are those for organs. These are both church organs and home organs. Upright pianos are way down, and grand pianos are kind of steady, but they're not growing, and every other category is. Especially accessories and school music and even fretted instruments and amplifiers. Amplifiers haven't been doing well for a few years, but even those are creeping up, so the numbers are a little bit better. Now, where are people buying from? Here are the top 10 retailers. The first is Guitar Center, and that's no surprise. They're at $2.3 billion in sales. Number two is Sweetwater, and Sweetwater is way behind at $618.3 million. Number three is Sam Ash, and they're way behind Sweetwater at $318 million. American Music Supply at $306 million is number four. Full Compass is number five at $140 million. And then everyone else is below $100 million in sales. Number six is B&H. Number seven is Washington Music Center. Number eight is J.W. Pepper, the print music warehouse. Number nine is Steinway Hall Retail, somewhat of a surprise. Number 10 is Alto Music. Now, as far as the top online retailers, we're looking at worldwide. Who are these top retailers? Well, surprisingly, it's Music House Thomann in Germany. They're number one. Sweetwater's number two. American Music Supplies, number three. Guitar Center, and this is Guitar Center in all their forms. I think they have like three or four different types of retail sites that they're actually selling from. They're number four. Music Store Professional in Germany is number five. Full Compass, number six. Bax Shop in the Netherlands is number seven. Soundhouse in Japan is number eight. Gear for Music in the UK, number nine, and B&H Photo is number 10. Now, if we look at the total numbers of all this, we find that the online music sales in the United States are larger than the rest of the world combined. Yeah, we sell a lot of gear online, and we buy a lot of gear online, and I think that's only going to continue as we go forward. I'm really surprised when people actually buy guitars online, because that used to be at least the one part where you wanted to go into the store to find the instrument that actually fitted your style the best. But even that's changing, and people don't have any qualms about buying a guitar or a fretted instrument online. Now, one other part in this that's very interesting is Reverb, the online used music gear site. Just topped $1 billion in sales, $600 million this year alone. So Reverb is really starting to kill it. And we're seeing that eBay, in fact, and the Recycler and Craigslist and all those other sites that used to be really big for used gear are kind of falling by the wayside, as Reverb is becoming the go-to site to buy your used gear. The Distressor is one of the few modern pieces of outboard gear that's become a classic and stands in the same league as compressors such as the 1176 and LA-2A when it comes to standard pieces found in studios everywhere today. Dave Durr is the creator of the Distressor, Fatso, and other totally unique hardware outboard devices, and he's my guest on this week's podcast. In the interview, we talk about his life as a professional musician and recording engineer, his time spent working at Eventide, how the Distressor went from idea to product, and the whole story behind other Empirical Labs products. We spoke via Skype from his office in New Jersey. Boy, it's a pleasure to talk to you, I have to say. I'm glad we can talk in depth, because I've always had a lot of questions for you. So now's a good time here to get to it. Let's start with your background. Are you from Philly by any chance?
Philly area. I was originally born in Delaware. But when I was in a group, a band for many years, like all of us, Philly was a main place that we played at, along with Baltimore, Washington, and New Jersey, too.
Got it. Okay, so you were a player for quite a while, right?
Yeah, many, many years. I was actually a music major in college. And then, yeah, played in a, we had a band, Jack of Diamonds, for, thinking 10 years, something like that. Maybe more. I was around 32 or 33 when we kind of went our separate ways and off to do other things.
Okay, so how does that take you to Empirical Labs?
That's a good question. First of all, my family is all very technical. I had two engineer brothers. And of course, you know, they're always doing science and all kinds of little experiments, and I was fascinated. You know, they're over a decade older than I. So when they were in college as engineers, you know, I was the little kid that always wanted to know what the what this did and what that did. But essentially, when the band broke up, I ran into a guy at Radio Shack, because I was always doing little projects and stuff. And he had seen the band. And I started just talking to him. I was asking him originally about some ICs and stuff because I was always technically interested. And of course, in a band, you have to learn how to fix your guitar cables and replace pots. So start talking to this guy, and he goes, "Well, you know, your band broke up. So what are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "My company, which is a medical company, may have room for a technician if you're interested." And he was in Philadelphia. The company was a medical EEG company. So I started working there as a electronic technician. So that was really my first kind of move in away from full-time music to electronics. And then I was lucky. I happened to see an ad from Eventide for an engineer. And I said, "Well, I'm not really an engineer, but I have been reading all these manuals and technical journals." And I had actually taught myself basic AC analysis through a Radio Shack book. And so then I sent up a little resume that just said, "I'm doing this." I was in a band. And I was lucky. Richard Factor, the owner of Eventide, had actually seen my band. And he calls up a friend of his who was in another band, Rob Grenoble, who owned Water Music for many years. And next thing you know, Rob says, "Oh, you should hire Dave. He'd probably be good because he knows music and knows instruments and might be able to help out in a different way than some of the schooled engineers did." And I ended up getting a job. So from there, it was, you know, there I was. I was in the industry, equipment manufacturing industry.
When you were with Eventide, of course, Eventide was into digital way before anybody else, and it was a hybrid of analog and digital. What side were you working on? I guess the analog side, right?
Yes, especially initially. And let me, one of the funny things that happened to me, I was put in with a group of real engineers, like guys with, you know, masters, but more importantly, experience, had turned out projects, serious projects all their life. And of course, you know, I had repaired guitar cables. So, but I had started making little projects and stuff, all analog. But being put in with some major guys who are now have their own companies, I'll mention Ken Bogdanovich from Sound Toys.
Yeah.
Bob Belcher also from Sound Toys. And those, that was the three of us really that I got put in. And the funny story I was going to tell was I failed miserably on the first two projects Eventide gave me. I really just spun my wheels, and I'm sure there was a point where they're kind of looking at me saying, "Was this a good hire?" You know, but, Ken B, then I got thrown into, the audio, division specifically, whereas before I was doing a number of slightly off center projects. And I'm not proud to say, but admit to failing at them. You know, I literally didn't know where to start on some of them. But when I got put in the audio department alongside my friends Ken B and Bob Belcher, they were really patient with me. And they were my mentors. I took copious notes. I wouldn't say I was a quick study, but I was a good note taker. So that got me going with those guys. And they were very patient, like I said. And I just tried to not say too much usually and listen a lot, you know. But the H3000 was the product that I was put onto, and there I did the analog section initially.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, are you kidding? I was so lucky to get that job, and especially lucky to be teamed up with two patient guys, because, you know, there's a lot of engineers, they don't want to play with someone that, you know, no, you use this formula, you know, to do that. And then they would have an attitude. And these guys had no attitude. They were very patient with me. So I was very lucky in many ways.
You know, we have a similar background because I was always the guy that was fixing cables and making sure the PA worked and all that stuff, too. And I was trained in college as an engineer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, the only time I ever had an engineering job was when I was kind of forced to because my band had broken up and, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So for 6 weeks, I worked in a telecommunications company.
Same with me, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Same with me. You know, I wasn't going to go into electronics, but when the, you know, when your love kind of says, okay, I'm not paying the rent. Very interesting.
I worked in this telecommunications company for 6 weeks only. And what it was basically it was a phone system. And it was a high-tech phone system for the time. This was in about 1980 or so. And they put me in a room by myself, and along the walls were nothing but schematics. And I would get a broken circuit board that would come in that would have, you know, the problem. And I was supposed to troubleshoot it by looking at the schematics and then just writing out, okay, change this or this. And I would never know if I was right or not because it went out to the text and the text did all that stuff. And the only way I knew that I was wrong was if I saw it come back in again.
Okay, I gotcha.
Needless to say, I was not very good at that. And I lasted about 6 weeks. And then, of course, I got another gig playing, so that was more important. I kind of share your background with that, where you're thrown in and you go, oh, wait a second, I don't know if I'm prepared for this.
Yeah, trial by fire. It was, there was, you know, definitely a lot of moments where I'm like, this might be not be where I should be, you know, yeah. Or are they going to put up with me? How long can they wait for me to come up and do something useful? But again, with Bob and Ken's help, you know, and I did know op amps and stuff like that and basic analog circuitry. So, you know, I got to a point where I did finish a couple analog sections, and that gave me a little bit of respect, at least from me. I respected myself because I was pretty torn up. You know, when you feel like you fail on your first two projects.
Yeah.
And you already had the feeling you might be over your head. You know, I had a few sleepless nights, but that's what you do.
Yeah. How long were you at Eventide?
I believe it was 9 years, 8 years.
Wow.
It was from 7 years. I think it was 7 years because it was from 85 to 92. So 7 years. I remember now I started in end of 85. So
did you leave to start Empirical Labs?
In a way, yes. Empirical Labs, I had a recording studio that was starting to make money and, you know, okay money. And that was owned by a company I'd started, Empirical Labs. So technically, yes, it was to leave Empirical, it was to start Empirical Labs. But in reality, it was to work in my own studio owned by Empirical Labs.
Got it.
And of course, the whole time I'm starting to think, you know, I'd like to do this product, I'd like to do that product. So,
well, you had the background, you knew how to do it then.
Yeah. At that point, I actually had some experience working alongside some, you know, king engineers.
Let's talk about the Distressor. And I'm sure this has been asked so many times of you. So forgive me because I'm sure you've gone through this a lot, but I'm curious, and I know a lot of people listening will probably be the same. What was the impetus for the Distressor? And I say this because it's so unique. It's such a different product. You know, many times I've looked at it and I thought, how do you even think about this? So where did it come from?
For some reason, I'd always had a fascination with compressors and gates, even within the band. Because I remember we would have, you know, be in the studio and working on everything, and all of a sudden the engineer might throw a compressor on the drums or something. And I go, what's that? What did you do? You know? And so that got my fascination with compressors started long before I was any kind of electronic engineer. And at Eventide, you know, they made a lot of, they had the Omnipressor, which was a fun little device. I didn't work on that or anything, but I did play with it. And when I had my studio, I had a bunch of new, you know, compressor devices with only one or two that I would call character devices. And that was a Gain Brain 1. Was definitely to me a character device. And then right when I was the last year or two of at Eventide, I'd saved up some money and I bought an 1176, actually two 1176s, I had an API for a while, but that was just borrowed a compressor. And I had LA-2A, which I actually got from Ken B, who was working. He had bought it while at Eventide, and I kind of absconded with it. And those were like eye-opening, you know, as you can imagine. If you're working with, say, an Alesis compressor, or I did have some DBX-160s, which, of course, were very utilitarian.
Yeah.
But they weren't the kind of thing where you could, they would fundamentally change your sound that much. But when I got the LA-2A, and especially 1176, and the Gain Brain 1, I got a Gain Brain 2. Unfortunately, I sold the Gain Brain 1 to get the Gain Brain 2s, which were a totally different beast. I learned after quite a bit of time. But those fundamentally changed the quality of what I was working on in the studio. And I got to work alongside a Phil Ramone's engineer before he was Phil Ramone's engineer, John Patterson, who was introduced to me through a friend at the medical company of all places, came and was looking for a studio to do, off the line work, you know, basically, because he was working in big studios in the city. And when John came out, he really showed me the magic of like the LA-2A on vocals, the 1176s, which were really old black faces. So there was the start of why do these change, make me sound like a better engineer and make my my attempts at a record sound more like a record. So with that in mind, I started, you know, doing a little research, playing with little circuits and stuff. And that was the gist of it. I'm never a clone person. I have no desire to just clone something. And even when we did our Rouser, yeah, I had no interest in just doing the Distressor. So even though the Distressor was my own product, right, it was why do something you've already done when you've learned stuff? So I think that was the start. I had the fascination for the compressors, and then when I got these two or three compressors that changed my sound, I was on a mission. And that was when I started playing breadboarding and testing circuits and stuff. You know, very early was I loved FET compressors. That was a no-brainer. The Gain Brain 1 was a FET compressor. And I really liked that. Again, when I got the Gain Brain 2, that had become a VCA-type compressor. And the 1176. And at that time, this is, again, I got my 1176s. I'm thinking, I should look, but I'm thinking late 80s, before I died. And you couldn't get new ones at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking around inside, poking around inside, couldn't get schematics. You know, the internet wasn't happening then. So I reverse engineered a lot of it and looked around. And very early on, I said, you know what? There's pretty good VCAs out there now. You know, ICs that 1 volt in is 10 dB more out or whatever. But I said the sound that I like was these FETs and the tube stuff too, obviously. But FETs have a very similar quality in their harmonic generation as tubes. So I think that sealed it for me. So right off the bat, I said I knew the gain control was going to be a FET. And I've never regretted that decision since.
Okay, so you don't want to reverse engineer anything or clone another product, and I get that, I understand. That being said, you have similar features, and I'm talking about Nuke and Opto and British Mode. So you're not exactly cloning something, but yet it's the features and the feel, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. At what point is something a clone or something inspired by something, you know? And the thing that I had learned at Eventide was, you know, a little bit of digital about digital controls, obviously, and circuitry. So I'm looking at these old discrete devices, and I want to be able to get the sound, but more mostly initially for my own use, I started developing tests, and I started saying, well, you know, I don't have an optocoupler in here, but I have an optocoupler compressor that I really like, and I can see what that is doing, like time constant wise, with harmonics, etc. And so I'm looking around, I'm going, well, gosh, with this new IC or newer IC, I can possibly switch in this circuit that'll give a new release shape, add another time constant to what I have now, and get an opto type response. So using newer technology, it kind of opened up what I could do. And I said, again, I don't want to build an LA2. I don't want to build an 1176. But now with these, I'm looking at these new tools and new technology. And it's honestly, it wasn't even that new at that point. Some of the ICs that I used to pull that off are probably already 10 years old, maybe even more. But no one had really used them to enable you to get certain sounds. And again, because the LA2A and 1176, you really couldn't get at that time. I said, gosh, if I could get that out of my own box or get the vibe, you know, out of my own box and have this versatility. And then I was like, that's what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to add some of this modern technology in here to be able to switch stuff around. And literally, I put different compressors in one box. And I think that kind of is what you were saying, where we got this versatility and you got the vibe. And it really, I think 1,000, 2,000 people could have done it, but it's making the commitment. And again, it was 2 or 3, 4 years before it went from the concept and breadboard to actually going out the door.
Wow.
So it was, it's just like anything. You got to make the commitment and get started. And from there, you know, stuff can happen.
How'd you come up with the knobs? Because the knobs are so unique looking and they've become the icon of the company.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny. I'm looking for a knob here. I was going to hold one up. That's a really good question. Because one thing that I always liked about the old devices, there was these great big knobs that the outside of the skirt, like if you move it 1/16 of an inch, you can get back to that. You know, the actually circumference was so big. And immediately I said, you know, that's such a good feel. You know, you don't have this touchy little knob that you're never going to be able to write down where you were. So I got a couple big knobs. And then the next thing, of course, was I started using this thing on sessions very nervously because people are paying me. And I'm kind of like, would you mind if I tried this this thing on your vocal, you know? So when I started doing that, I need to recall some stuff immediately. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't have a lot of markings on these knobs. Then the search for the knob started. And this was about 93, I would say, a year after I got out of Eventide. And I went through some of my friends that were coming into the studio remember me going, what do you think about this knob? You know, what do you think about that knob? And anyway, we ended up with a big knob, and I found a company that made a knob that was kind of what I wanted, but the colors were different. But they had a million marks, the same marks as we have on there now, but the knob was clear, which didn't work for me. So I had them customize it to be an all-white knob. And that, you know, that's the waiting period between saying, can you do this for me, and then actually getting it was very long. So they said, well, it's going to take us a month or two. And I said, okay, well, can you send me the current knobs, the clear knobs that you have? And they did. And I took a can of white spray paint and went outside and on a piece of cardboard, spray painted the back white. And I said, yeah, that's a look. You know, you haven't seen any white. You still don't see that many white knobs, yeah. Right? So, and when Gil, our distributor from Wave Distro, had worked at Eventide with me also, and he left shortly after I did. When I showed him the knob, he goes, oh, that's really ugly, but really different, you know? And that was it. And it has since, as you say, we've really tried to make it a symbol of our company because they are big and very identifiable. And Bobby, we just got a trademark for that.
Excellent.
We have a trademark for our knob, meaning it's ours. Yeah. You know, basically we own that knob, that look. And of course, there's all kinds of permutations of that trademark. You need to get protected for software and for pictures and stuff. But we spent almost a year basically going through the process of getting it trademarked so that, you know, it's our IP, actually.
Yeah.
And it was not easy. It wasn't easy. You know, a knob's a knob to a lot of people.
Yeah, sure, sure. The Distressor is so versatile and can be used in so many different ways. I'm sure you've talked to tons of users. Is there one way that people seem to use it more than others, or ways, I should say? Is there something that keeps on popping up in a way that people are using it?
The answer is yes, there is. Initially, when we started demoing it, you know, drums. When you demo at a show, which is... It's another story there with Mercenary Audio. But our first AES, subtlety doesn't sell. So the first thing we did at our first AES was get a really bad sounding drum track, which we still use to this day, and smash the heck out of it. And people, that sold. And people to this day, of course, still, that's one of their main uses is smashing drums, room mics, snares, kicks. So that's one huge use for it. The other common use is the opto is used very often on bass and vocals. Vocals more than bass because, again, I spent a long time trying to get the vibe of the LA-2A, which is, as you know, a major compressor for vocals. So those two settings, I would say, pop right out in my mind. But then people soon realize that you can use it invisibly. And, you know, so for tracking, we gave a lot of people a little ideas in the manual. You know, don't use Nuke while you're tracking.
Yeah, right.
Unless it's a room mic or something. But, you know, people started realizing you can use it on a lot of different instruments. And if I may, just deviate a little bit from the subject. The one we had some sound sources which really showed the flaws. I had made several compressors by this point before the Distressor, probably I'm guessing 6 to 8 breadboarded compressors, optos, VCAs, all kinds of stuff, and certain sources. And let me mention those. First of all, acoustic guitars they're hard to get that gleam in your face, warm, big sound without getting the spiky pick noises and all that crap, or without modulating and getting really fuzzy. And bass guitars, really hard on some compressors.
Yeah.
You know, and you'll find, for instance, one thing I use DBX-160s for in my studio all the time was bass, because David Blackmer, who designed it, had this little circuit in there that adjusted its attack and decay times depending on the source. So with a bass, which was a slow moving signal, it would slow things up and you wouldn't get nasty modulation, distortion, static, stuff like that. Cause a lot of compressors will get staticky with a bass, but yep. Believe it or not, cause when you go up with that low frequency, it's all of a sudden chops it off. So I used acoustic guitars and bass. The drum smashing, you don't have to be clean, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was really easy, even with the first prototype, which was very dirty. I got that vibe right away on room mics, the neat vibe. And again, my engineer who worked for Phil Ramone, a guy named John Patterson, got very excited by that right off the bat. But then we both saw the limitations when I tried to use on acoustic. Got spiky. The attack was actually too fast at first. I didn't really scale things properly. But using those different sources, I slowly tweaked it over the years. And bass, again, a lot of it was setting the right attack time and the right release time. But we also added a little circuit in there that gives a little bit really fast so that the main compressor doesn't have to chomp so hard. I call it a sponge circuit, which I've mentioned before. And it gives a little bit very quickly, and it makes the job for the main compressor easier. And that it allows you with acoustics. I was very happy with the way the Distressor came out with acoustics. In fact, I won't mention names, but there's a lot of guys that's their go-to compressor, especially while tracking. Bass was kind of fell in line at the same time, honestly. So initially, it wasn't that as versatile as I wanted. But, you know, you work on things and they get better. And over a year, we tweaked and tweaked and tweaked. And I think that's where the versatility slowly appeared.
Well, speaking of which, you continue to make improvements on it. And now there's a new version, well, new to me anyway, where there's a lot more things. And I'm just wondering, is this coming from you playing with it, or are you listening to the market?
Both. As an example, originally, the original link did not lock the left, if you had two channels, did not lock the two channels together. In other words, the left side could respond differently from the right side, even though you had the link button on, because we did not link the actual control signal. We linked the audio. So we call that phase link, because if you have drastically out of phase material, the compressor won't turn it down as much. So mono compatibility is good. But right off the bat, within the first year even, complaints, the left side's doing something different than the right side. And so immediately I said, well, let me see what we can do. So we started looking around and found a way to join the two gain control signals. And we added a little switch on the front panel that let you do that even with previous units. In other words, you could update the original unit to have what we call the image link. And so I listened to that. And the other thing too, we got one of my big influences and has become a very dear friend of mine is the engineer Michael Brower. And my friend John Patterson knew Michael. I didn't know Michael at the time. This is, again, about 96, something like that. And John said, can you put one of these together so I can give it to Michael? Because Michael's a compression fiend. And I said, okay, yeah. So we had I only had like two employees or something. I had him make one, and we sent it in to Michael. Brower is working at, I think, Sony. He's working at Sony. And less than a week later, I get this phone call. I'm looking for Dave Durr, and I go, and we're working out this little dumpy house, by the way, at the time. My dog, my girl, and, we were still doing some recording sessions, so it was a busy, noisy, messy place. Michael says, Dave, I wanted to talk to you, and I don't know who he is at this point. He goes, this is Michael Brower. I go, oh. Okay, yeah, you work at Sony. John Patterson told me about you, and he goes, did you make the Distressor? And I said, yeah, and he goes, man, I love this thing. He goes, I would like to ask you a favor if I could come out and visit you. And I'm like, I'm thinking, you know, dirty dishes, dog, you know, it was just a mess. And I told him that, and he goes, I don't care. I just want to see where it's made, and I want to meet you. And I go, really? I goes, I'm hoping this is in a good way. You know, you're not going to hold me, take me to court or anything. He goes, no, I just really like this. And I go, oh, I'd be honored if you'd come out. And of course, the internet was happening at that point. So I get online and start looking, and there wasn't a lot about him online, but I did find it. I thought, oh my God, this guy's mixed some amazing records. So I'm very nervous when this, I think it was a Beamer pulled up to my little house next to my 72 Impala. Michael had a lot of influence on us. And all that story was to get around to what we call the Brit mode. Brit, you know, when you push all four buttons in on the 1176?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I couldn't do that in any way directly because the circuitry is very, very different. But, and I didn't even know what it was. honestly. I think I might have seen somebody do that, but didn't really take note of it. And he was very enthusiastic if we could do that. So that was the next month or two. I said, let me see what I can do. I had 1176s there that would do it. And I had test sources put together. So again, responding to a major person in the market, we added the BritMod. BritMod is what we call it when we modify your unit. And people really like that also. And again, we had to do it kind of a different way than the 1176 does it. But with my test sources and tools, and I was able to get really close.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank Michael for pushing that on me.
Well, okay, let's talk about software for a second. So it took you a long time to give in to, I guess, people asking you for a plugin version. And now, of course, it's Universal Audio that came out with a plugin version of the Distressor and kind of a version of it with the Rouser, right? It's kind of a Distressor with more on it.
It is. It definitely was to capture the Distressor vibe. But then you have, you know, other, I'm not going to mention any names unless you want to, but there's, you know, probably four or five clones out there right now.
Yeah.
Distressor clones. And of course, that's the serious form of flattery.
Yeah, right. So when you did a Rouser, did you do that in-house?
We have a guy that actually isn't working in our building, but we do all the testing here. He has his own development facility that we work with him very closely. And basically, it was to our spec, and we test the heck out of it along with the other engineer here. So it is, we spec'd it out. It's not like we gave a Distressor to somebody and said, copy this.
Yeah.
We kind of started from a different method. And I knew, you know, with my test when it was right. But for me, the goal was, I saw these clones had been, as you said, people were asking from 96 on, when, you know, the year we put it out, can you do a plug-in? Because Waves was out there doing stuff. And so right off the bat, I said, you know, I've learned a lot, and there's some things I would like to idealize. There's some things that the Distressor does, but it's not quite, say, predictable or not as variable and controllable. So one of the goals was, again, not to just hand someone a Distressor and say, copy this. It was to get all the vibe of it, but then to idealize a lot of it a lot more. As a quick example, there's a lot of examples, but the attack knob. The attack knob on the Distressor, you go to about two or three, and you're at about a millisecond. We start at like 50 microseconds. But up to about three, you're still really fast, really fast. You know, within the range of an 1176. And with the Arouser, and then again, once you get up to five on the Distressor, all of a sudden the attack jumps and goes up very quickly. It's not crazy unsmooth, but it's not as smooth as I wanted. So on the digital thing, I kept all the main points in about the same place, but there's little, as they call, break points in pots that I got rid of.
Yeah.
So that there's much smoother. And then, of course, I could let people read out in milliseconds and seconds and dB what the knob was at. And you can't do that with a real Distressor either.
Yeah, that's very handy.
I love it, especially for me testing it.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I want a dB more to match this test I've already done. Type in a dB, enter, done. Instead of trying to go, nope, you know.
Yeah, right.
It becomes pretty quick and easy.
Okay, for a company that's been around 20-some years, you don't have a lot of products.
No.
I get the feeling that for you, you're very deliberate about what you put out and very selective about what you put out as well, and it kind of has to pass the Dave Durr test before it goes anywhere. That being said, Fatso, where did that come from? Because that's another unique product. There's nothing like it, really.
Well, you know, you just said about it had to pass my test. That one very nearly didn't. I had spent, by the way, there's actually, I should know the amount. I think there's four or five products that we actually kind of designed and haven't seen the light of day and may never. But the Fatso was, you know, this is now, we're into the digital age, you know, 96, 97, DAWs are actually working now reliably. You know, we are indeed into the digital recording age. And of course, one of the things that people all along were saying, oh, it's harsh and I want the smoothness of analog tape, you know, what can you do? So again, listening to people and, you know, reading and me starting to use ADATs at one point, you realize that analog tape did help you. I had a big old Atari tape deck. Before that, a 3M 16 track, which was really analog.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was great. What fun that was.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to think, well, so let me try to quantify what makes the analog tape sound. And so slowly I said, okay, well, first of all, you got to saturate a little more. A lot more than the distressor does. You have to have, you know how the analog tape will fold the high frequencies down. Like when you put a snare in there, you're not going to get back what you put in on that front edge. And fortunately, it's a pleasant thing. It's musical.
Yeah.
You know, it collapses that front peak a lot. So I said, so I want a soft clipping, but I need to have a high frequency effect, which is, on tape, it's the result of the bias frequency, which erases tape, being added with the high frequency in the audio. Mm-hmm. So the audio actually becomes part of the biasing and self-erases. And that's why you have that warmth. The high frequencies fold on analog tape. And that was tough. I wish I could do it a different way now. But we basically created a dynamic filter for that, high frequency dynamic filter. I'm like, and what about that low frequency bump? And the transformers, all those old tape decks had transformers in them too. And so the shortest path was to put a transformer in it. But we did it differently, because transformers, as you know, can respond differently depending on where they're coming from and where they're going to. So what we did is we're right in the middle of the circuit. We plopped a little teeny inexpensive transformer that was carefully chosen, but we knew where it was coming from. We knew where it was going. I adjusted those impedances, tuned it with caps and resistors and whatnot, and all of a sudden we got this nice low frequency bump when you enable the tranny. Tranny has a whole new meaning now, but we called it tranny on there for transformer, and it did a really good job, because we didn't try to simulate it. We actually put a transformer in there, and it does a low frequency thing that was, I'm sure other people, a better engineer, could probably do it without a transformer, but this transformer is only a few dollars, and because we put it right in the middle of the circuit where it's very controllable, it got that vibe. It's actually a little bit of cross between the low frequency vibe of a tape deck, you know, where you've got that little bump.
Yeah.
I kind of put that bump in there. I think it's a little above 100. Very small bump, like 1 dB, you can hear it. And lastly, because of a lot of the circuitry was there, for instance, we did the saturation in the Fatso with FETs. I said, might just be able to use that as a VCA too. And so the next thing, we started putting a compressor in there. So we ended up with four types of processing in there. Would you like to hear the story of how that almost didn't get to the market?
Of course, yes.
Lots of parts. Tremendous amounts of parts. It's got over 1,000 parts. I should know the exact number in my head. But tons of parts. And that resulted in cost. And I'm looking at this thing saying, first of all, what is it? You know, if I'm going to try to sell it an expensive box, how do I define this in a sellable way? And honestly, we never did. But we said it's a tape simulator. But we got to the point where I'm saying, okay, this is really expensive. This is going to be over $2,500 probably for me to make much money on it, make it worth selling. Very hard to make. So I said, well, I'm going to beta test it anyway. And by that time, we had a few major guys that I could actually say, you know, I'm going to send you this box. I wouldn't record through it right now, but would you mind just playing with it? And George Massenburg, big help. I was lucky to have met George in 1971. Just a kid, and a bass player kept telling me about this really good engineer over in Baltimore. And I was lucky. He drove me over there one night, and I meet George. George had hair down to his butt at that time. And I remember he had just finished the session. We had timed our arrival with the finish of the session, and he played back some of it. And I remember, you know, at that time, my experience in the studio was quite limited. I'm sitting there going, wow, this is what studio is, you know? And of course, George Massenburg, that set a reference for me that has yet to be exceeded. So George had gotten one of the first distressors too, and really him having that in his rack probably sold the first 500 for me. So when I got the Fatso, I was like, let me call George, and just because he's got the ears, and I think at this point he might be willing to take the time to play with it, you know. And Brendan O'Brien, who had also become kind of a distressor fan, and at this point grunge was happening, and of course what could be more suited for grunge than an analog simulator, you know, in the digital world, because grunge was all about, you know, this fat warm analog sound. Those are the two main guys. And again, in my mind, I literally had already said, this isn't going to work, this isn't going to be a product after 2 years of hell, you know, because of the cost and because of how do I tell people what this is. Anyway, thanks to George and Brendan, they both came back and said, oh, I really like this. I'd like to get another one, you know. And George, I said, George, you've helped so much with the distressor. You just keep that one. I said, it's kind of a prototype, but, you know, it's got all the stuff in there and we'll see what happens. And Brendan, I kind of said, Brendan, we don't really have any more. And he goes, well, how much would it cost to make one? And I said, well, you know, that the metal, you probably know this, custom metal works very expensive. It's not worth doing for one piece ever. So I said, well, I said, I could probably do 10 at a minimum run, but it would cost this much money. And he goes, well, I'll tell you what, I'll cover half of that. And I said, really? And so all of a sudden in my mind, I went, okay, I don't know what this thing is. I don't know how to sell it. But these two main guys, whom I have so much respect for, like it. So I've got to like it, you know. Yeah. And anyway, that was how that ended up getting going from the trash. And we made a run of 10. Then we made a run of like 30 and 40. And people kind of learned what it was. You know, they learned it was a tape emulator with compression in it. And we've sold thousands and thousands of those over the years.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I thank George and Brendan. I thanked them in person a bunch of times, but I'd like to thank them publicly once again for pushing that out the door for me.
This has been so much fun, and there's so much more I want to ask you, but I don't want to take up too much of your time here. Hopefully we can resume this somewhere down the road here.
I'm here for you really anytime. You know, it's such a low commitment. I don't have to fly anywhere.
So. Yeah, I'm with you there. Okay, last question then, Dave. What is the best piece of business advice that maybe someone imparted to you or you learned along the way?
I've gotten some really good advice over the years. I just posted something on Facebook, which is a big part of it. It was basically if you want to, the first step in anything is getting started. You know, so many times you have all these ideas in your head and you say, oh, I could do that. I have a better idea than that. And for years you think that, but you never actually sit down and start. So one of the first things is to just start. And if I'll show you the prototype of the distressor, you can see it's a little PC board, you know, maybe 3 inches by 5 inches. And that was the start. It wasn't a big start. It wasn't a sellable product. So the first thing is to get started and do baby steps. Number two, try to avoid partners.
I love
it. As sad as that is, try to avoid partners because my experience has been there are good partners. There's definitely good partners out there, and they make that rule obsolete. But the thing that I had seen happen right around when I started selling the Distressor was a lot of friends who were designing things, and they got financial partners and stuff. And the next thing, when they started making money, they didn't make money because the partner was basically taking a huge, taking that the fluff that made it worth doing off the top. So if you're the one that's going to be doing the design and actually creation, try to fund it by yourself. Try not to have silent partners. They're not ever silent. And lastly, I'll just give you three examples of business advice. Jeff Dakin, who's become a very dear friend, who was from Delaware originally too, which is where I'm from. Jeff has been so good to me. He's given me a lot of advice, but the piece I'm going to pass on is about growth. And this, in a way, can hold you back. And it has in a way, you get in a comfort zone and you to grow is very uncomfortable. But his piece of advice was to read this article by Northcote Parkinson. Said, Dave, I want you to read this slice out of one of this guy Northcote Parkinson's books. Jeff, I had a lot of respect for, and I didn't even think not to because he sent me the link, you know. Northcote Parkinson was a British general, I believe, or Navy admiral or something. Anyway, and his whole thing was different size of groups that produce. And he would tell you that, you know, one person is very easy to manage, it's yourself. Two people, you know, pretty easy. Above about five people, you start having some trouble. And above about 20 people, it's a whole different ballgame. But the piece of advice was, and we've seen people go out of business from this, don't grow your company until you have to grow your company. Mm. In other words, we just had a supplier go out of business. They were made metalwork for many years out of a kind of a small building, and it was very cramped and very, you know, wall to wall with metal sheet metal and stuff like that. And they always turned a good profit. And what happened was, they decided they wanted to grow, and they got this giant 50,000 foot or something facility nearby, hired more people. There was a slight economic downturn. They had this huge nut that they never had before, and 2 years later, they're gone. So I've always followed that. And for instance, we worked out of that house I told you about with the scary dog and the dirty carpets and everything. Until literally we were tripping over each other. And it was at that point we all said, we need more room. And then we went to another house. We moved into another house that was bigger and worked out of there for over a year until we were tripping over each other. And then we bought a factory building. And we're now starting to trip over here. And I'm thinking about making the next move. So. But those would be my three pieces of advice. One, no partners. Two, basically grow slowly. And three, grow only when you absolutely have to grow. Be very careful.
You can find out more about Dave and Empirical Labs at empiricallabs.com. EMPIRICALLABS, Empirical Labs, all one word. .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com, select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, and Google Podcasts. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.